From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On the Senate floor this morning, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell delivered his harshest rebuke yet of President Trump and the deadly insurrection by pro-Trump extremists 2 weeks ago as Congress was meeting to certify the election results.
The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people. And they tried to use fear and violence to stop a specific proceeding of the first branch of the federal government, which they did not like.
Meanwhile, there are no public events scheduled for President Trump on this, his last day in office. He's preparing for a big military send-off, which happens tomorrow, a few hours before President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in. And for the first time in recent history, the two men will not see each other during this formal transition of power. Let's bring in Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent. Hi, Mara.
Hi there.
An NPR poll out today shows that most Americans think Trump will be remembered as a below average or one of the worst presidents in U.S. history. And now, as we heard, the top Senate Republican is calling him a liar who provoked a riot. What jumps out to you about the polling and McConnell's comments?
Well, they are quite harsh. Maybe they suggest that McConnell is willing to vote to convict President Trump when the Senate holds its impeachment trial. We don't quite know when that's going to start. But it's an extraordinary situation. Everything about this transfer of power is unusual. First of all, it's the first time in American history where we haven't had a peaceful transfer of power. As you pointed out, there was a violent attempt to stop the transfer of power at the Capitol last week. It failed. This is also going to be the first time since Andrew Johnson that an outgoing president has not attended the inauguration of his successor. The first time that his family won't be graciously meeting with the new president and their family the way Michelle Obama and Melania Trump did, the way Laura Bush and Mrs. Obama did. And the other thing is that Washington, D.C. right now is an armed camp, and because of security concerns, and also the inauguration ceremony itself is going to be relatively depopulated because of COVID.
Do we know if the president plans to speak to the American public before he leaves office?
We assume that he will, but there's no official word on exactly what he'll do, whether he'll give a video message or whether he will speak at Andrews Air Force Base. He is planning to leave the White House tomorrow, go to Andrews and have a military ceremony send off there.
What is expected to happen at Trump's departure ceremony tomorrow? And what will actually happen inside of the White House during that time?
What happens inside the White House is that the White House is going to be deep cleaned because of COVID. It would always be cleaned. And the Biden's stuff will be moved in and the Trump's belongings are moved out. There are some holdovers in the residential staff that Trump hired from his hotels. We don't know if they're going to stay or not. But the big thing that's missing, as I mentioned, is this gracious handoff where the first families meet. We've seen it every time. Every transfer of power includes a picture on the North Portico, usually of the new president, the outgoing president, and their wives standing together. And that is not going to happen this time.
There are some practical reasons why that typically happens.
Well, yes, you want to make it as smooth as possible for the new family. And remember, the backdrop to all of this, you mentioned that NPR poll that just came out. 65% of Americans in that poll said that they believe Joe Biden is legitimately elected, but 70% of Republicans do not. They believe the falsehood that somehow, even though this election wasn't close, Trump won and had it stolen from him. And that is a big cloud hanging over the new president. And by not meeting with him, by boycotting the inauguration, Donald Trump is trying to keep that falsehood alive.
Well, Mara Liasson, it's Robin here. I'm just going to jump in to ask you one last question. This evening, President-elect Biden will speak at a national remembrance for coronavirus victims. He's hitting the ground running. He's got, you know, first day actions like rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement. No cabinet, though, in place yet. And Trump's second impeachment trial looming in the Senate. And we just heard these harsh words from Mitch McConnell. Many are probably trying to interpret those with the trial looming. So what's your sense of how Biden's approaching his first days in office?
Well, Biden is starting like a lot of presidents do with a flurry of executive orders. A lot of them are undoing executive orders that Trump issued. That's very typical. But he also is not just hitting the ground running. He's kind of hitting the ground sprinting. He's laid out an extremely ambitious agenda for not just for the first 100 days, for the first 10 days. He first and foremost wants to get a vaccine program up and running. It's been very sluggish. He says he's going to deliver 100 million doses of the vaccine in 100 days. He's going to send legislation on immigration to Congress on day one. There are a lot of things that Biden can do on his own through executive action, especially standing up the vaccine program. He does need congressional help to pass legislation for COVID relief and also immigration and other things. But as far as impeachment, that trial, he is determined to keep it at arm's length, focus on the pandemic, leave the fate of Donald Trump to Congress.
We'll leave it at that. Mara Liasson, national political correspondent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, what is next for the far-right extreme groups who showed up in support of President Trump in the attack on the Capitol? Fear of more violence at state capitals led to lockdowns, but that didn't surface. And analysts caution that the extreme right still poses a complex and evolving threat. NPR's national security correspondent Hannah Alam joins us now. Welcome.
Hi there.
This is your beat. You cover extremism. You spent the weekend reporting from Richmond, Virginia, a city that was on high alert, especially around the state capitol. So how'd that go first?
That's right. Well, this was Virginia's lobby day. It's a big day for the state's gun rights lobbyists in particular. And last year, 20,000 Second Amendment supporters flooded into Richmond. This year, the turnout plummeted because of the security situation on top of pandemic restrictions. So what ended up happening was the more mainstream gun rights activists organized caravans, but they couldn't really meet up because of all the blocked roads. So pretty much the only ones who were near the Capitol were members of various hard right factions, the Proud Boys, some militia groups, the so-called Boogaloo Boys. There were also a handful of members from militant black gun clubs, but all of these groups showed up in very small numbers. In fact, they were outnumbered by journalists, but they were heavily armed in defiance of a local ordinance banning weapons in that area. And they bragged about it, talking openly of instigating violence. For example, this is Virginia Boogaloo Boy, Mike Dunn.
The only answer to our problem, the only answer to this governmental infringement is order and revolt. And I'm proudly guilty of sedition.
Oh, proudly guilty of sedition and armed, as you said, in spite of a ban. So what happened? Was he arrested?
Right. Well, perhaps you're thinking, surely not 2 weeks after the Capitol attack, the authorities moved in on guys with long guns publicly calling for the violent overthrow of the government. But no, the authorities stood by and watched. And I've seen them do this before in Richmond. It seems to be a strategy of sort of letting them blow off steam rather than risking an escalation by detaining them. But we should note that that's a restraint we don't typically see extended to, say, black and or Muslim demonstrators, whether they're armed or not.
So pull back for us, Hannah. What is what you saw in Richmond? Tell us about where the right-wing extremist threat is heading.
Well, I think the small turnout we saw not only in Richmond but at other state capitals only underscores how the more established, the more organized groups are keeping a low profile right now. They're under a lot of scrutiny, especially if they had a presence at the Capitol. And leaders of various factions say they're thinking long term. They're not in a rush to pop back up right now. Some call this weekend's events a trap by the feds to lure them out. As one told me, quote, I don't want to be in jail when the Civil War starts. So, of course, that's a more face-saving line than, uh-oh, guys like me are under investigation. We're losing our communications platforms. We've essentially been driven underground. So, you know, domestic terrorism analysts stress that the threat isn't necessarily from just those known groups. You know, extremists are increasingly self-radicalizing through online propaganda and networks. And plus, there's still a risk of political violence with extreme elements of the MAGA crowd, concern over QAnon and other conspiracy theories radicalizing people as well.
Yeah. Well, and here we are on the eve of inauguration. Has President-elect Biden given any signals about how his administration will deal with this threat?
We've heard Biden using forceful rhetoric, you know, specifically naming the threat. He's repeatedly called the mob that stormed the Capitol domestic terrorists and white supremacists. But those are words. We don't know yet what kind of policies he might introduce. The Biden team has picked some veteran counterterrorism officials for national security posts. That's reassuring to some, an indication that maybe there will be a renewed focus on preventing and fighting homegrown extremism. At the same time, that makes some civil liberties advocates nervous. They don't want to see the same missteps of the so-called war on terror, where, you know, essentially whipping up a hysteria that's disproportionate to the threat and handing the government expanded powers that end up being abused. Those practices stigmatized ordinary Muslims and left a big stain on the country's record of civil rights and civil liberties. So I know that after those shocking scenes at the Capitol, everyone wants to know, how can we prevent this from happening again? And the answer is, we don't know yet. We don't know what kind of right-wing opposition will emerge from all of this, how violent it might be, whether the Biden administration will consider it a national security priority. But certainly the Trump era flung open a door for violent ideologies to enter the mainstream, and it's going to be very difficult to close it.
NPR's Hannah Alam, leaving us with a chilling thought there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Confirmation hearings begin today for some of Joe Biden's nominees to key positions in his administration. Among them, the Senate Armed Services Committee is considering his choice for Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. And the Intelligence Committee is hearing testimony from Avril Haines, his pick to be Director of National Intelligence. NPR's national security correspondent Greg Myrie joins us now. And Greg, both of these nominees will actually make history if confirmed. Let's start with Haines. Who is she?
She's got a fascinating personal story. She grew up in New York City and right after high school went to a judo academy in Japan for a year and then studied physics at the University of Chicago. And she loved building things and she rebuilt the Cessna plane, including the avionics, and was flying it from Maine to Europe, but had to make a crash landing in Canada. And she ultimately married her flight instructor on that trip. And she graduated from the Georgetown University Law School in her early 30s and then began this quick rise through the government. And she was working on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and that's where she got to know the chairman, who was Senator Joe Biden at the time. She followed him to the White House, worked on the National Security Council, then became the number two person at the CIA, and now Biden has picked her to be the first woman to be Director of National Intelligence.
A varied and impressive history. What are we hearing from her so far?
Well, she made several points at her hearing this morning. One is really rebuilding trust and confidence across the intelligence community. President Trump has had so much friction with the intelligence community, so her intent is to create a better atmosphere. Number two, China is going to be much more of a priority. The rise of its military, its extensive spying, its theft of intellectual property. So that's going to be a real focus. And then finally, I would just say it was a pretty cordial hearing. Both from Republicans and Democrats, I think we can expect a pretty quick and easy confirmation for her.
Let's talk about Lloyd Austin. He's a retired four-star Army general. If confirmed, he will be the first Black leader of the Defense Department. How much of a factor, along with his experience, did that play in Biden picking him?
Yeah, I mean, he has this very impressive resume. He grew up in Georgia, attended West Point, held a number of very important positions as he rose through the ranks in the military. But Biden emphasized that choosing the first Black defense chief was a pretty important message. This comes at a time when more than 40% of the military is made up of minorities, and yet there are few senior Black leaders. So I think this was definitely a part of Joe Biden's thinking.
And his nomination, though, is complicated by the fact that he only retired from the military 5 years ago. I have about 15, 20 seconds with you. Can you explain that?
Yeah, there's a rule that you have to be out of uniform for 7 years before you can become Pentagon chief. So Austin will require a waiver. This will require votes in both the full House and the full Senate. Those votes are expected in the coming days, but they are separate from today's confirmation hearing.
That's NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie. As always, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, President Trump has recorded a final message that could be released before he leaves Washington tomorrow. He's skipping the high-profile televised farewell speeches past presidents have made. Exiting President Barack Obama delivered his in Chicago 4 years ago.
The work of democracy has always been hard. It's always been contentious. Sometimes it's been bloody. For every two steps forward, it often feels we take one step back. But the long sweep of America has been defined by forward motion, a constant widening of our founding creed to embrace all, and not just some.
Here Now's Alex Ashlock has this look at how other presidents have said farewell.
Let's start with the fact that two of our most famous presidents never got the chance to say goodbye. Abraham Lincoln was assassinated just days after the South surrendered, ending the Civil War in 1865. And Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945, before the end of World War II. Vice President Harry Truman succeeded FDR, and he made the decision to drop atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, leading to Japan's surrender. Truman was elected on his own in 1948. He bid farewell in 1953 during another war, this one in Korea.
I suppose that history will remember my term in office as the years when the Cold War began to overshadow our lives. I have had hardly a day in office that has not been dominated by this all-embracing struggle, this conflict between those who love freedom and those who would lead the world back into slavery and darkness.
In his farewell, Truman did something most outgoing presidents do. He wished his successor well and urged Americans to support him. Dwight Eisenhower followed Truman into the White House. He was a five-star general who helped plan the D-Day invasion. But as president, when he left office, he did so with this warning.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
Eisenhower spoke on January 17, 1961. 3 days later, John F. Kennedy was inaugurated. His presidency ended with his assassination in Dallas in 1963, and his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, took office. Johnson's presidency saw historic progress on issues like civil rights, but dogged by Vietnam, he decided not to run for re-election in 1968. So he used the 1969 State of the Union message to say goodbye.
I hope it may be said 100 years from now that by working together, we help to make our country more just. More just for all of its people, as well as to ensure and guarantee the blessings of liberty for all of our posterity. That's what I hope. But I believe that at least it will be said that we tried.
Richard Nixon followed LBJ into the White House, but his presidency ended in the Watergate scandal. His emotional farewell to members of his administration and the White House staff was impromptu and was forced by his resignation.
You are here to say goodbye to us, and we don't have a good word for it in English. The best is au revoir. We'll see you again.
Richard Nixon on August 9, 1974. In more recent years, these farewell addresses have reflected the tenor of changing times. After his two terms in January 2001, Bill Clinton described his hopes for the future.
We must remember that America cannot lead in the world unless here at home we weave the threads of our coat of many colors into the fabric of one America. As we become ever more diverse, we must work harder to unite around our common values and our common humanity. We must work harder to overcome our differences. In our hearts and in our laws, we must treat all our people with fairness and dignity, regardless of their race, religion, gender, or sexual orientation, and regardless of when they arrived in our country, always moving toward the more perfect union of our founders' dreams.
8 months later, with George W. Bush as president, the 9/11 attacks rocked the nation and affected everything after. Bush launched the invasion of Afghanistan and later the war in Iraq. He delivered his farewell address on January 9, 2009.
I've often spoken to you about good and evil, and this has made some uncomfortable. But good and evil are present in this world, and between the two, there can be no compromise. Murdering the innocent to advance an ideology is wrong every time, everywhere. Freeing people from oppression and despair is eternally right. This nation must continue to speak out for justice and truth. We must always be willing to act in their defense and to advance the cause of peace.
There are echoes of the very first presidential goodbye in all of these speeches. George Washington's farewell in 1796 was a gesture of humility. The man who could have been king said the people should choose their next leader. He would not seek a third term. Washington also warned of the dangers of partisanship and the influence of alliances with foreign powers. Washington's words continue to resonate literally.
I rejoice that the state of your concerns, external as well as internal, no longer renders the pursuit of inclination incompatible with the sentiment of duty or propriety, and am persuaded, whatever partiality may be retained for my services, that in the present circumstances of our country, you will not disapprove my determination to retire.
Each year, typically in February, a member of the Senate reads Washington's farewell address aloud on the Senate floor. Senator Chris Coons had the honor in 2016. It's a tradition that started during the Civil War in 1862. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlar.
To become a world champion in freediving, Tanya Streeter learned to breathe like this. Ideas about air, breath, and breathing. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
President-elect Joe Biden is announcing his nominees to lead two key financial watchdog groups. Gary Gensler will serve as Commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission, and Rohit Chopra will be chosen to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The two nominees signal that the Biden administration is likely to push for more aggressive oversight on Wall Street. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Welcome.
Hello.
Gensler earned a reputation as a tough regulator during his time in the Obama administration. He actually helped craft the Dodd-Frank legislation that regulated big banks after the financial crisis. Nomination indicate that Biden will actually be tougher on Wall Street. I mean, tougher than Trump or maybe even Obama.
Well, definitely Trump. I don't know about Obama. Look, this is a little bit different. We are not in a recession that was caused by an amplified bad behavior on Wall Street. So if we go back in time, we look at Gary Gensler's tenure at the CFTC. A lot of people thought this was going to be a terrible choice. They thought because of his career on Wall Street, he was at Goldman Sachs for a long time. He was also part of the Clinton Treasury Department, which opposed strict regulation on derivatives. People thought Gensler wouldn't be tough enough. And as it turned out, he was really tough, and he imposed very strict restrictions on derivatives, tougher than the Obama Treasury Department had even proposed. You know, when I talk to banking executives, the term they use almost uniformly about Gensler, he's a reform smoker. I think that's probably good news for people who want a little more regulation.
Oh, interesting. He's also expected to focus on investor protection and the rise of cryptocurrency. What kind of obstacles do you think he might face, especially from the conservative courts?
Well, you know, look, the head of the SEC can't just snap his fingers and poof, make policy, right? Regulation takes time. It's the formulation of policy. Then there's always this comment period. And then you might get rule changes. And even then, as you say, those regulations can be challenged or watered down, even eliminated through the judiciary. So that will be a problem. I mean, I think that what's really important here is that that focus on digital assets is going to be fascinating right now. Gensler comes from CFTC. A lot of people have compared the way that digital assets trade to being like a commodity. And remember, last year, Bitcoin up by 300%, and more smaller investors are getting involved. So I think that's going to be an interesting area of regulation.
Mm-hmm. Progressive leaders are also commending Biden's choice of Rohit Chopra to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. An agency criticized for propping up big business. Is Chopra expected to return the agency to its mission of helping protect consumers from fraud and abuse?
Oh, absolutely. You know, remember, CFPB, it was the brainchild of now Senator Elizabeth Warren. The first director there was Richard Cordray. He used the agency's broad powers. He clamped down on so many different industries. It was payday lending or credit card company practices, for-profit colleges, lending, auto loans, also even the ability of an advisor to provide advice to clients who had to maybe put that client in the best interest of the client or the advice in the best interest. I think that what's going to be really important now is to see the CFPB focus and really say we are leading with the C, the consumer. That's going to be really interesting.
That's Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you.
Take care.
There's been a lot of yelling and not a lot of listening in the political sphere recently, but our next guest says in his case, it was a man thing. Now, we love our male colleagues at Here and Now, but raise your hand, ladies, if you've ever suggested an idea only to watch it be shot down and moments later suggested by a male who's treated like Albert Einstein. You don't have to watch Mad Men to know that women have been leered at but not listened to for decades. There are studies that blame it on the male brain or a need for control, but how to change? Well, in Stuart Watson's case, it took being slapped, fired, getting sober, and working hard to have a relationship with his birth mom and family. Stuart Watson is a Peabody Award-winning former investigative journalist. His new memoir, What She Said, What I Heard, How One Man Shut Up and Started Listening, is something he aims to do in his podcast, Man Listening, where women tell profound stories while Stuart listens. Stuart Watson joins us now. And Stuart, in our reading, you are clever, a great reporter, and sometimes a jerk. A woman at work slapped you right across the face after a crude comment, and your therapist told you to shut up, you're wrong.
I was paying this person, I was paying this woman to help me, and instead, sitting in sessions on a couch across from her and arguing with her about what the problem is. And she pointed to her degree on the wall and said, listen, you're paying me for my consultation, not to come in here and argue about how you're doing so well. Like, if you're doing so well, what are you doing in here? So please listen to me when I provide feedback to you, and don't argue with me about the basic facts of how this therapy is going. And I was like, you know what? She's right. I did ask to come in here, and I am paying hundreds of dollars, and I am doing nothing but arguing with her. And so the critical thing is that it wasn't working for me.
Right. Well, and you say, frequently wrong, but never in doubt, my male ego wants to do three things: look good, be right, keep control. You soon start to weave your family story in. And I'm wondering how much that being in control is about the thing you could never control, that you were adopted. You had this search for identity. You grew up privileged and sheltered in a white Southern family. You locate a birth mother and birth siblings, find out about an alcoholic dad who died way too young. You inherited his disease. You said you had this narrative in your head where you were going to swoop in and heal everyone when you went to meet your birth mother. And on your first meeting with her, you said to her, I forgive you. And what did she say to you?
She said, oh, honey, you don't have the power to do that. And it really just sort of rocked me back on my heels. Just because I said a few words didn't mean that all this incredible pain from being separated on the day of birth was going to go by the way.
And then there was that other moment after you took some sort of questionnaire that concluded you were an empathic listener, and your wife tells you, sweetheart, you are not an empathic listener. You set out to prove her wrong. You recorded conversations with women. You listened back to the tapes. What did you hear?
When a tape is transcribed and someone talks on top of someone else, then the transcription says crosstalk in all caps. And I was appalled at the number of times that I interrupted, butted in, talked over, argued. And I mean, it was right there. It's a clear metric that I was not listening. So I set out to prove my wife wrong that I was this wonderful, empathic listener. And I ended up proving her right. And I determined there's some simple things I could do, starting with shutting up and genuinely trying to take in what they were saying and not making it about me.
Was it simply like an inner voice or counting to 10 and just saying, don't talk? What was it?
Well, the shutting up of the mouth is just the first thing. Then I have to shut up all that interior dialogue that's just preparing to leap into the conversation and explain my part, as opposed to quieting the mind and taking in what someone is saying. You know, I worked for 32 years as an interviewer, as a professional interviewer, and never thought about, you're not just leaping ahead to the next question or making it about getting to the soundbite that you want for the local TV news. It's about genuinely opening up and entertaining the possibility that I could be all wrong in my judgment about this person. And then asked an open-ended question, something like, I don't understand, or I'm not sure I'm tracking you, or I don't know what that word means.
You're saying you let go of looking bad, not knowing, being wrong, or losing control. And now you have the podcast, Man Listening. Let's take a listen to one of the episodes. It's a woman named Robin, and she is dying of alcoholism. Let's listen.
I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but I never thought that fast forward 3 months later, I would be in a hospital room at 2 o'clock in the morning, unable to eat, dying of end-stage liver disease. And my five-year-old can't come in to see me anymore because I'm the color of a mustard jar. I'm yellow as a mustard jar.
Stuart, she ends up getting a last-minute liver transplant. What happened?
Well, she's makes me want to cry. She's a beautiful mother. She's alive. She's fully alive.
I'm wondering if allowing yourself to not be in control got you to be able to listen to that.
Well, certainly we're both people in recovery. She is me. I'm her. My consequences were different than hers. My disease was arrested at a different time than hers, but I have no, you know, superiority to her. And so I really do hear her story in a different way.
Another recent podcast featured actress and singer Kenya Templeton. It starts with you. Let's listen.
Now, this is one that I'm nervous about asking.
Okay.
What would you like sung at your funeral?
Ooh, Motherless Child.
Let me hear.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
Stuart Watson, you are just listening.
Yes. Yes. Beautiful.
Yeah. It's amazing what you hear when you listen.
It really is. It can change you.
Yeah. That's Stuart Watson, an award-winning former investigative journalist. His new memoir, What She Said, What I Heard, How One Man Shut Up and Started Listening. And also, as we just heard, his podcast is called Man Listening. We'll hook you up at hereandnow.org. Stuart, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure.
Those are the bells from St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Philadelphia, ringing out 400 times on Sunday to recognize the nearly 400,000 lives lost to COVID-19 here in the United States.
Tonight, President-elect Biden will be at the Lincoln Memorial to remember the many Americans who've died of COVID-19. He's also encouraging cities across the country to participate at 5:30 Eastern Time by turning the lights on in buildings and ringing their church bells.
In Philadelphia, bell ringer Ben Cornelius says after he finished his duties, he came down from the bell tower and noticed people standing around the churchyard.
People came out and listened and were contemplative and clearly were affected by what the sound of the bells was doing and what it was bringing to mind for them. And there were people who were crying, and you know they were thinking of loved ones who had died. It's a bit of therapy for me, I'll say, to do this, as well as to ring tunes on most evenings from the church as well. So honored to participate in it.
Cornelius says he's planning to play some special tunes for the National Memorial tonight, like Amazing Grace and Abide by Me.
And COVID-19 has hit close to home for him.
three of my coworkers have died of COVID. So it's had quite an effect on my railroad world.
He's an essential worker for the Metro North Railroad in New York. On a hopeful note, he got his first vaccine last week and plans to get his second shot in a couple weeks.
Ben Cornelius says he plans to continue to ring the bells at his church in remembrance as the pandemic claims more lives every day.
Chaotic times in America always seem to throw us back to one year, 1968. Democrats were planning a nominating convention in August. Sitting President Johnson, who'd passed historic civil rights legislation, was considered a shoo-in. Then he escalated the war in Vietnam. In March, anti-war activists like Tom Hayden and Rennie Davis announced demonstrations that would be nonviolent and legal. The Yippies, Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, called for a convention festival. LBJ withdrew. Then in April, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. In June, candidate Robert Kennedy was also gunned down. In August, all the pain and anger of the year poured into Chicago. Protest leaders begged police to let people sleep in the parks. There was nowhere else to go. They were denied. The confrontations with police and armed National Guard at curfew were televised around the world. Here's how ABC News described it.
Hundreds of marchers and dozens of policemen were injured. Restraint was absent on both sides. This was later called a police riot.
But first, a year later, leaders of that protest, including Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Tom Hayden, were put on trial for conspiracy and crossing state lines with intent to start a riot. From the start, the judge, Julius Hoffman, seemed determined to convict and control a trial that included Judy Collins and Country Joe McDonald as witnesses and defendants who dress up in costumes and blow kisses to the jury. The story is dramatized in the new Netflix film, The Trial of the Chicago Seven. Frank Langella stars as Judge Hoffman and joins us now. Frank Langella, welcome.
Thank you.
You were unique among cast members like Sacha Baron Cohen, who plays Hoffman, because you were alive in 68. What do you remember about that time?
Well, I remember I was 30, and I wasn't a very good citizen when I was a young man. I was ambitious for my work and my life. I paid very little attention to the politics of the day.
So this movie is for you almost a way to go back and learn more about a time that you lived through. But let's give listeners a sense of the character you play, Judge Julius Hoffman. In this scene, one of the defendants, and this is Black Panther Bobby Seale, who it's a whole separate storyline. He did not belong in this trial at all. But he makes a motion to represent himself, and this is supported by another defense attorney. Let's listen to how your character, Judge Hoffman, responds.
Are you now speaking on behalf of Mr. Seale?
No, Your Honor. I'm speaking on behalf of the other defendants.
You're standing right next to him. Why don't you just represent him?
Because I'm not his lawyer, sir. If I understand, Mr. Seale, this last month and a half, and I believe I have, he is not represented by counsel.
Overruled.
I am being denied right
Mr.
now.
Mr. Seale.
My constitutional
will you be quiet?
Right for
will
legal
you,
representation.
Will you be quiet?
Oof. This was difficult to watch. Hoffman would eventually order Bobby Seale to be manacled, gagged, while sitting in the courtroom without representation. As you're playing this man, kind of reprehensible in that moment, what forces are you gathering to do that?
Well, he's reprehensible throughout. He doesn't have a single redeeming quality. He is a pawn of the government, not very bright. And I felt, with Aaron's wonderful guidance, I felt free to make him as much of a monster as he reportedly was.
Well, you mentioned Aaron Sorkin, who adapted this screenplay from all true life events. And in case anyone's thinking that you're a little over the top here, Slate wrote, as unbelievable as it seems, Judge Hoffman, who was born in 1895, really did act with the malice shown in the film, dismissing objections from the defense before they were made, arbitrarily excluding evidence, witnesses, even jurors. Not the first who some considered negatively that you've played, Richard Nixon. In Frost Nixon, you played the handler of the spies in The Americans. Where does this character fit? And in your head, is there ever like a Rolodex of, you know, people you've inhabited?
No, they come and they go. I don't have no comparison at all to Nixon. If there's anyone I compare him to, it's Skeletor in Masters of the Universe, which I did for my son when he was 4 years old. It was a joy to play a man who had no conscience and knew from the moment he walked in that he was going to convict them.
Yeah. To people who say to you, and maybe they do, maybe they don't, but we've had a lot of people trying to compare what's happening recently with 1968. Is there a comparison?
Oh, well, of course there is. Look, government is always corrupt, always, all the way back to the teapot, all the way back. In our country and in other countries, power corrupts. That's a cliche, but it's true. My hope is that President Biden will start us on a saner path, but it doesn't mean all corruption is wiped out. It just, that's not the way it works.
That's Frank Langella. He stars in the trial of the Chicago 7 as Judge Julius Hoffman. The film is available on Netflix now. Frank Langella, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.